Session number 11369, Peter Walpole, Reel 3.
Lieutenant Commander Peter Walpole, Reel 3.
Yes, I'd just described how the helicopters that flew around the task force at about 400 feet looked like small black dots moving around. And so really my first thought on seeing something black and smoking as a small dot was essentially that this may well have been a helicopter in difficulty, a helicopter that had been shot or something and was smoking. But not knowing really what on earth it was, I did what most officer watches do as an instinctive thing, is take a bearing of it from the compass. So I took a bearing and I seem to remember it was 297. And I reported to the ops room that there was something smoking bearing 297. I didn't know what it was. And again, I looked at it through my binoculars and was having great difficulty trying to sort out what it was, because there was no relative bearing movement on it, up, down, left or right, and so it appeared to be stationary or suspended in air. But smoke was, what seemed like smoke was coming from behind it, and so the impression was of one of those speeded up films of a flower blossoming. The smoke was just billowing from behind and making it grow in appearance, but didn't seem to be moving anywhere. And I think really simultaneously, either with Brian Lation or Al Clark, we realised that this actually did have a bit of movement on it. It was coming towards us, and that it was a missile. But that realisation really came very late, really at comparatively short range. The Sunday Times, I think, quoted me as saying, "My God, it's a missile," but I think I probably said, "What the fuck is that?" Not really knowing at all. There was then a matter of seconds before impact, but I remember distinctly in those final seconds, having not noticed any bearing movement on this object initially, I noticed that it was beginning to draw right, and the perception of this sort of thing is something that officer watches acquire in shipping situations. So in the final seconds before impact, I just had some sensation that it wasn't coming directly for me. It was going for the centre of the ship, and that as such there was the prospect of surviving. But that was just a fleeting sensation I had in the final seconds before impact. For some reason I wanted to go to the bosun's mate position, which is at the port hand, that's the left hand rear side of the bridge, to activate the main broadcast alarms. But in fact I never got there. I was on the deck at the time of impact, and it really was the most frightful crash, and a very strange sensation, a bit like your worst car accident, 10 times worse, in the sense of noise and pressure wave and the sound of the explosion. I mean, the sound was terrific, and also the sense that just prior, a second prior to the impact, there was a perfect working ship, and that a second after it was irrevocably changed, and immediately afterwards anything that was loose on the bridge was scattered in all directions. There was a tremendous amount of dust that came out of the ventilation trunking all around, so the place was instantly showered in paint fragments and dust, stuff that had been there collected for years and could never be shifted. And because of massive interruptions to power supplies, there were a series of alarms that had initiated on the bridge. You can cancel these by pressing the button and then it just flashes the light at you, but So there we were with this tremendous noise, and afterwards the sound of alarm bells ringing, and a whole series of actions to be taken to try and find out what's going on. So after picking myself up from the deck, I checked that all the other members of the bridge crew were all right and uninjured, which they were. We were obviously very shocked at this explosion and the obvious impact. And I remember trying to get through to the ops room below. In fact, I also recall just prior to impact having shouted down a handset to the ops room to take cover. I think I remember saying that twice before trying to go and activate the main broadcast alarm. So afterwards, the quartermaster tried to take over the wheel and tried to take over control of steering and engines, but I think he had a hard job to do that. There was already smoke coming from, beginning to seep out of the ventilation trunking, and also it was obvious that there was a major fire on the starboard side of the ship midships. And in a very short space of time, we had to evacuate the bridge as the smoke became made the bridge untenable. And though I seem to remember a couple of people came up to the bridge. I think the captain probably came up to see what was going on, but we were able to tell those who'd come up that we'd been hit by a missile. So the next thing I remember distinctly is evacuating the bridge. And obviously with hindsight you wish you'd taken far more things, perhaps a chart or perhaps one of the portable radios that was kept inside, but it seemed to be important to get the people out and away from the suffocating smoke. And once out, and a lot of the ops room crew in fact just came out onto the starboard upper deck, they didn't come all the way up to the bridge, the smoke was billowing from within the bridge, and eventually the doors were shut. So once we had been evicted essentially by smoke from the bridge, we never got back inside the ship. Having reassembled ourselves out on the upper deck, the people, some of the upper deck crew who had manned some of the positions closer, much closer to the impact, were out there and clearly suffering from shock. So we sat them down, and one chap was there with no eyebrows and momentarily unrecognizable as who he was at first, but he'd obviously suffered from a flash burn as the fire had swept it up over the side of the ship. Obviously ships are able to withstand a certain amount of damage, but my perception of just how bad it was took a turn for the worse when I looked and saw flames leaping about nearly 100 feet in the air from the opening. And this was a combination, I think, of the ruptured fuel tanks in the side of the ship, the fuel igniting, and also the paintwork on the starboard side of the ship, which I suspect got caught up in the flame as well. Because the flames didn't last very long, and they actually died down and turned into a sort of a more of a smoking fire, obviously raging inside, but not producing the same flames visible on the outside of the ship. I do remember seeing the most enormous flames and thinking I'd never see anything like that. And then started some 5 hours of firefighting and effort to try and save the ship, which ultimately we were defeated. It seemed important to try and establish some sort of command position at the bridge. I was at least still equipped with the binoculars that were around my neck. And I still have them to this day. I think it's one of the few things I walked away with, other than my life, of course. And I remember going on the bridge roof to try and look around and see if there was any more threat coming from a further attack. I remember looking around to see if I could see any other ships as well, or aircraft. And I remember a tremendous sense of relief when we were overflown by a Harrier, and I thought at least someone else must have seen what had happened to us, because we were some distance away from the other units, and while they would have seen us smoking, they probably wouldn't have had any idea of what was happening to us. So when a Harrier came over, it felt as if someone was at least patrolling us. Then as the fire continued and the effort to try and provide water, firefighting water, continued as well, and the afternoon wore on, the other ships came and joined us. But I remember perhaps a slightly stickier moment before we were joined by other ships, when this tremendous pall of thick, acrid smoke billowing out of the side of the ship was being carried by the wind, mostly in one particular direction. It seemed to be either going aft or going over the ship out to the port side. But at one stage, it came forward to envelop the bridge, and it was so thick that you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. I knew where I was on the bridge wing, but it was also very suffocating stuff as well, and I reached one stage where I thought, well, if this stuff doesn't start to clear pretty soon, I'm going to have difficulty breathing, and so is everyone else around here. But the wind seemed to be only a temporary change of direction. It went away again. Al Clark, the observer, jumped down onto the forecastle to try and help with taking charge of the firefighting down there, but eventually they decided the best thing was to get the helicopter off, as it was important to speak to one of the other ships on a radio, and the only working radio was in the helicopter. So they jumped in and switched on the batteries and flashed it up and started to speak and eventually took off to bring more firefighting equipment to us and to start to evacuate the casualties as well. Obviously, we lost people, some 20 people on the Sheffield, but there are others who were just casualties who could be got off. And they started with the manoeuvring of those, although I know that after the first time that Al and the helicopter landed on the Hermes, they weren't allowed to take off again. They'd gone there for more fuel, but I think quite sensibly, following the traumas they'd had, they decided that they would not be best if they flew again. I remember one of the old Type 12 frigates, I think it was the Yarmouth, who came alongside us, again to offer firefighting assistance, and they had hoses rigged on their forecastle. And they came alongside our starboard side and were trying to pour firefighting water into the hole. I remember one of our other crew also got afloat in our little Gemini inflatable dinghy and likewise managed to eventually rig up a hose and try and see into the hole and see how much the fire was in there. I remember the Yarmouth being manoeuvred very close alongside our starboard side with a very skillful piece of manoeuvring. And I think also she then had a fleeting sonar contact and was off in a great hurry firing anti-submarine rockets. I just remember thinking it was great to have ships around offering moral support just by their presence, even if they could only offer limited firefighting support. And then the Arrow came alongside our port side and again began the similar sort of process of having rigged her own fire hoses, trying to use those. And eventually, by connecting hose onto hose onto hose, she passed across hoses to us that we were able to use. And I remember the marine engineering officer with those hoses trying to effect a re-entry into the forward auxiliary machinery space, which is one of the spaces that was actually hit. I don't think they ever managed it. We spent some 5 hours, I think, fighting the fire and eventually got off at about 7 o'clock at night. And there was plenty of nervous energy to keep us all going, and we were determined to try and save the ship, of course. I think I remember shouting across to the Arrow that we wanted some food, so they showered us with Mars bars and things. It's good to have that sort of stuff. But eventually, the captain, who I remember seeing him wandering around the forecastle and feeling compassion for the burden he must have been carrying at the time, decided that the fire was well out of control and we were unable to do anything about it, that the deck, which was already hot underfoot to touch to us up on the bridge areas, was even hotter down closer to the Sea Dart magazine, and that it was imperative that the ship's company were evacuated. The ship was essentially beyond saving with the means we had at our disposal at the time. So when the order was given to abandon, we then had to move aft Not quite sure why we were moving aft, but it seemed that was the way we were going. So we had to get across the central area of the ship that was the bit actually blazing with fire. And I remember clambering down onto the port waist of the ship, the upper deck sort of companionway that runs along the port side, and making a dash through the hot centre section to get aft to the flight deck, where people were being essentially the Arrow, which was alongside us, very close on the port side, was inviting us to jump across the gap. Excuse me. Well, after the order was given to abandon, and there seemed to be various options, but the one that seemed best to me was to get across to the HMS Arrow, who was alongside our port side. And here, it really just became a question of self-preservation, because the ships were not permanently alongside, they were sort of bouncing on and off each other, and there was a gap that had to be crossed. The gap was widening and closing as the ships rolled, and the sea carried them apart and back together again. I know that the Arrow was sustaining quite a bit of damage as she was riding alongside us. And this was to be a question of timing, and I had this brief flash of all those days at school doing long jump, thinking this is the time, you'd better make it work. So I picked my spot, which was up on a little companionway that runs along the port side of the hangar, and where there happens to be an HF reception aerial that looks a bit like a bird bath. And this particular little platform seemed to me to give one of the best positions for jumping across to a part of the Arrow. There were already members of our ship's company over there, and they were providing mutual support by sort of shouting, saying, come on, you can make it, make the jump. And I had just watched the navigator make his jump, which I think he slightly mistimed. And he had a bit of a scrabble to get up, but he was helped by some people who were already there, ready to catch them. And he managed to get his feet down between the gap of the two ships as they began to move together, but he just got lifted out. And having seen that, I thought, well, I'm not going to miss this one. So I made a jump for it and found myself on board the Arrow. I think the buffer was there, sort of a key senior rate, a very stalwart character, just sort of chap you need in a time like this, who was congratulating those who'd made the jump, well done, sir, sort of thing, off you go. And somebody spotted that I still had the officer watch's binoculars around my neck. Amongst all the other equipment you carry, I had my sort of gas mask case, but I'd actually already used the gas mask as a scoop for water to conduct some cooling of the upper deck, so I was without my gas mask. So as I had the binoculars, I thought the best thing was to stuff them in the case, and they may come in handy one day. We then were quickly taken below, and in a very short space of time, the Arrow seemed to be heading off at high speed to counter some new threat. And I remember we were split up then. The officers led off to the wardroom, and the senior rates and junior, or the junior rates certainly, down to the junior rates dining hall on board Arrow. And this made me feel rather uncomfortable, and I wanted to be with the rest of my division and make sure they were all right. So I remember going aft to find the junior rates dining hall, to find my senior rates, the radio supervisor and the yeoman, to make sure they were all right, and to try and get some feel for whether or not any of my people were injured, and what the toll had been on board Sheffield, as we clearly, some people were aware of those who hadn't made it or those who'd been trapped below. I seem to remember hearing that one of the regulating staff hadn't made it at that stage. And then the enormity of, obviously, the loss of life began to come through, although clearly, given the number of people on board Sheffield, perhaps 20 isn't a very large number for the loss of a whole ship in a single attack.
How many were there?
I think it was 20. I'm not sure.
Out of a ship's company of how many?
About 260. I remember the dimly lit dining hall and the sort of vibration and shudder as the ship headed off at high speed, but just essentially being relieved at finding out that the rest of my division were all right, as clearly they were the people I was most concerned with. And also, I did feel that splitting up the officers and men at such a time perhaps wasn't a sensible thing. But clearly, when you're just trying to sort out accommodation for people and where they go and where they're fed, it's a perfectly logical thing to do as far as the team on board Arrow were concerned. But I felt much better at that, and then returned to the wardroom, where there's a mixture of people, some who seem to be sitting around very, very shocked, very dazed, and others who are obviously trying to just get information. Information is always something you want. You know, who's there? Have you seen so-and-so? Where's this, that, and the other? Where's the helicopter gone? What's going to happen to the ship now, sort of thing, as it's been left?
Where was the captain?
The captain was flown to Hermes. I know that the flag staff were very keen to hear from the captain and some of the key warfare officers who were on watch, certainly the anti-air warfare officer and others, exactly what had happened. And I know that Al Clark, the observer and the flight commander who'd been on the bridge, were able to confirm to the flag staff that it was a missile, and they had seen the missile approach the ship. Clearly that was a bit of information that the flag staff were very keen to get, what exactly the nature of the attack had been. So, yes, split up from the captain and some of the warfare officers in that sense, but I think about half of us were on the Arrow, and half of us were in the Yarmouth, and I think another group, some of them actually jumped into the sea, and I remember thinking afterwards, you wouldn't have got me jumping into the sea, but that was a way of being rescued, because they were then picked up by a small dinghy and then transferred to another ship. But I think the Arrow was the only one who was actually bumping alongside us. So on reflection, perhaps most of the crew were on board the Arrow. Clearly it was an enormous burden to the Arrow, as she only had a much smaller ship's company and it had been swelled almost three times by the arrival of us. So we only spent one night aboard. I slept on the floor of the wardroom, having been offered the mattress from a good friend of mine who happened to be the observer on that ship as well. I think a meal and some sleep was what was needed, quite honestly, because it had been a fairly exhausting experience. And while the nervous energy and almost the jocular spirits had kept everyone going aboard the Sheffield, as soon as we'd stepped off, there was a great deflation. We'd lost the battle of the ship, and that was clearly a fairly demoralising time. But there almost wasn't time to be demoralised, because that evening we again went to action stations, and I remember thinking that if we're going to be attacked again, I want to be a little bit reasonably high up in the ship, not stuck down below. So I remember going to a sort of secondary command position up at the sort of bridge level, again feeling that if it were another similar attack, then somewhere high up in the ship might have a reasonable chance. But it was the next day, I think, that we got transferred.
I'm wondering, before you go on to the next day, the fact that you've been through this and you are now in a very vulnerable situation again, I wonder how you sort of reacted to that. Were you very frightened?
It was frightening, again, because of the slight deflation of having lost the ship. And I think also, and this will come out again later on in the other ships we were transferred to, the fact that we were essentially in the way of the ship, and that of the ship's company of Arrow, and that we had no job to perform. One of the great things about being at action stations is that every single person's got a job to do, and that occupies you and keeps your mind focused on something you've been trained to do. But that when you're just sitting around trying to find out what's happening and you don't have a job to do, that is very frustrating. And can be more alarming, if only because you've got more time to think about it. But I also think that somewhere creeping into the back of my mind at that stage aboard the Arrow was, well, you know, if you can survive one, you may be able to survive another. So perhaps the prospect of another attack is not quite so horrendous. Maybe having survived it, you think you can do it again, sort of thing. But obviously, a very frightening prospect.
And perhaps a few lessons learned. The fact that, you know, you made your way up to the position you thought would be safest.
Yes, I think that was a natural thing from having been an officer of the watch and being someone who likes to look out the window. It's a jolly good way of finding out what's going on.
5 hours when you put in the fire out, that seems a long time, a lot of time. Did it seem like?
No, it really did go by very quickly. I mean, I can remember individual things that happened, be it the realisation that we were still underway, the dramatic incidents with the Yarmouth and the Arrow coming alongside us. Another one where the missile gun director who'd come out of the ops room was incensed at having been attacked. He was full of rage, and he came out and leapt up onto the upper deck and without his glasses on, immediately got behind a 20mm cannon and started firing at the first air contact he saw. It actually happened to be a Sea King helicopter who took a massive dive and scurried away at great speed. But this chap was absolutely furious that the ship had been attacked, and the first thing he wanted to do was shoot back at somebody.
Are there any other little incidents like that you recall? No idiosyncratic behaviour?
Well, they probably come back to me in time, I suppose, now that I'm thinking about it, but...
You said you felt pity for the captain.
Yes, compassion, I think, more than pity. I mean, a small figure of stature, and there was tremendous concern written on his face. He was down on the forecastle, so I couldn't actually see him, although he did... He shouted up and asked me if I was in contact with the tiller flat, which is the space right down aft where you can control the rudders locally as opposed to from the bridge, which obviously was untenable at the time. And we were trying to establish communications with the tiller flat, and he said, well, if you can steer the ship and if we're still running on it some engines, head for South Georgia. He'd quickly appraised that we were not going to be taking part in any more fighting, and the best thing to do was to get the ship to somewhere where it could be repaired. That was obviously earlier on in the firefighting. Yes, I think actually the engines, one of the engines kept running simply because there was some sort of ready-use fuel tank which just kept the engine ticking over at a sort of idling speed, so we were going through the water at about 6 or 8 knots throughout. I think it may well have been in a large circle, because I don't think I ever managed to get control back of the rudders. Communication was very difficult. It was by a sort of sound-powered telephone from the bridge wing, and I seem to recall somewhere that we were getting horrendous cross lines, obviously due to damage or something on route. Or that people, when they got down there, couldn't actually take control of the rudders. Again, I suspect the thing that powers the rudders, of course, which is that is hydraulic power, was not available. Again, I can't remember precisely.
How well do you think your training prepared you for this? This is a very extreme situation. Had you been trained to cope with it, do you think, as much as one could be?
I think with the practicalities of firefighting, I'd say yes. Certainly that training is good and is realistic and was then. It hasn't changed essentially in nature, which is to put people through a sort of mock-up of a ship with large fires raging and get you to try and put them out with hoses and foam. So in that sense, yes, I mean, the danger of fire is something you're made aware of and how to cope with it and how to contain a fire and the conduct of boundary cooling and all these various important things. Yes, that training was good. And in a sense, that's maybe all that smoke and flame would have been far more frightening if you hadn't at least experienced it in training. I think really some of the other things I recall about the whole thing are how much of what happened in 1982 could be related to the things I had read happening in the Second World War. How war is 90% a boredom and inactivity and sort of 10% sheer bedlam and hell and panic almost. Although I must say there was commendably little panic on board. Everyone was very clear about what their duties were and everyone was trying very hard to solve the problem. And people seemed to be going about business in this terms of firefighting in a very matter-of-fact sort of way. I remember looking over the bridge wing down onto the forecastle, and there the doctor had established a first aid post and was there with his sort of little bag with a Red Cross on, busy tending people. I mean, they almost could have been sort of extras in a film or something. I mean, it was all just taking place exactly as we would have expected. I think the only thing that we were finding difficult was that we were essentially excluded from the inside of the ship while we were trying to fight. And obviously, as the day wore on and the afternoon wore on and the prospect of nighttime was only a couple of hours away, people were tired, people were hungry, and they could only keep running on nervous energy for so long. I think a couple of people also got a bit cold because there were some of the hose pipes being directed from the ships, the Arrow and the Yarmouth, occasionally managed to hit a couple of the ship's company.